I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Change is in the air, and we've got the numbers to prove it on today's show. At a time when tax revenues are declining and city budgets are strained, our first guest has a modest proposal that could produce big dividends for cities. Joe Courtwright is an economist for Impresa Consulting in Portland, Oregon, and his latest work shows how profitable it can be for a city to be greener, smarter, with less poverty. Want to find out what's happening in your neighborhood? Adrian Holovaty knows. He's the founder of everyblock.com, a website that gives you hyper-local news tailored to your street address. We'll give the site a test run and see what's happening on our block. Stay with us for today's Smart City right after this news. Another hello to our podcast listeners. You've probably heard us talk about our social networking site, My City. Well, we've added some new features to the site, including a widget for my Twitter stream and an embeddable Smart City audio player so you can add us to your blog or website. If you're not a member of Smart City, send an email to Scotty, the producer of Smart City, and he'll get you set up. The address is scotty@smartcityradio.com. I look forward to seeing you on the site, and now on with the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Everybody wants to live in a city with fewer people below the poverty line, with more transportation options, and with a better educated workforce. But what if by making your city smarter and greener, you can make it richer too? Our guest, Joe Courtwright, is an economist for Impresa Consulting, and he has produced a report called City Dividends that describes the specific economic benefits a city can earn by making small improvements in performance. Joe, explain the concept behind the city dividends. What are you measuring and why?
Well, what city dividends does is look at what gains cities can make from small but achievable improvements in each of three areas: increasing their talent, improving their sustainability, and reducing poverty.
And when you say increasing their talent, what do you mean by talent? How do you define talent?
The measure we use for talent is to look at the percentage of the population that has completed a four-year degree. And that's a good way of benchmarking the relative level of skill and education in a population. And so our calculation of the city dividend looks at what the gain in personal income would be if a metropolitan area increased the percentage of persons with a four-year degree by one percentage point.
How do you know what that would be? How do you make that calculation?
We know that education is one of the most powerful explainers of how well economies succeed. Better educated areas have higher incomes. And we know that statistically, across the 50 large metropolitan areas in the United States, a 1 percentage point improvement in college attainment is associated with about a $760 higher level of per capita income for the entire metropolitan area.
And so you can look at what that 1 percentage point increase would be and calculate the number of people, the additional number of people with a college degree, and then put a dollar figure on that.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's when the education level improves by about that amount, what would be the gain associated with the total level of personal income in the metropolitan area?
We talk so much about education, and everybody thinks, you know, their K through 12 system is broken. It seems today that fewer people are going to college. So I'm wondering, is 1 percentage point, is that, it doesn't sound like much, but is that a hard gain to make for most cities?
If you look at the variation across metropolitan areas, you get a sense of what's achievable and what isn't. The best educated metropolitan areas in the United States have about 40% of their population or slightly more with that four-year level of educational attainment. And the least well-educated of the large metropolitan areas have a little bit less than 20% of their population with a four-year degree. So it's very feasible to imagine for most metropolitan areas that they could get about a 1% increase, which is why we use that as a threshold for measuring this improvement.
I've heard you make the point, and I just want to give you a chance to make it here, that even though college attainment, four-year college attainment, is the point at which you are measuring, college attainment doesn't rise without everything coming before it rising. So more people are graduating from high school, more people are acquiring two-year degrees, et cetera.
Right. And what we're really measuring is a whole distribution of skills or education in the population. We're not just talking about moving people who are just short of a four-year degree past getting a four-year degree. We're talking about shifting the entire distribution of educational attainment to make the whole population better educated. But the way we measure it, just for simplicity, is to talk about where that fraction of the population who've completed the four-year degree are. But it's really about improving all along the educational spectrum.
Joe, I've also heard you make the point that the best predictor of a city's success is the percent of college-educated people in its population. True?
Yeah, we can statistically explain about two-thirds of the variation in per capita income across metropolitan areas just by knowing what fraction of the adults have completed a four-year degree.
What's the other third?
Oh, the other third is all the other factors that influence an economy, the composition of its industrial base and the productivity of its workers and cost factors and so on.
So if we were able to achieve this 1 percentage point gain in college attainment in the top 50 metro areas, or the top 51 metro areas, those metro areas with a million or more people, what value does that have to the nation?
Well, in the aggregate, a 1% increase for the top 50 metropolitan areas would produce a total gain annually of about $124 billion a year.
Okay, so that's significant.
Absolutely.
Let's go to the next dividend you described, and you called it an improvement in sustainability. Gosh, I can think of 1,000 things that might be. Tell me what you mean by an improvement in sustainability.
Well, the thing we focus on with the sustainability or the green dividend is driving. We know that driving is expensive, it costs people money, and that the more driving that people in a metropolitan area do, the more they of their household budgets they end up spending on transportation. So what we've done is compute how much people would save if they could reduce the amount of driving that they do by 1 mile per person per day.
This seems achievable. Tell me the range of vehicle miles traveled per day, per person across the top 50 metro areas. I mean, what's the spread look like?
The typical metropolitan area drives about 25 miles per person per day. The most compact and best transit-served metropolitan areas, it's under 20 miles per person per day. And then the most sprawling areas, it's like 35 to 40 miles per person per day.
That's actually a bit of a tighter spread than I imagined. And it's interesting to me when cities talk about sustainability or green initiatives, I rarely hear cities talk about driving, and yet every day urban leaders, City Hall, there are decisions being made about land use, about zoning, and about transportation. So it seems to me that this would sort of be front and center in a set of green or sustainability initiatives. Why do you think it's not?
You know, I think it's something that takes a while. You don't necessarily see immediate changes or returns in it. And there are, as you pointed out, there are a lot of small decisions that when added together really influence how much driving goes on in a metropolitan area. So it's about the patterns of land use as well as investments in transit and how walkable and bikeable a community is. So there aren't any silver bullets there. It takes a lot of actions over a long period of time to really move that number.
You live in Portland, and I know that you bike a lot of places, and I know also that you love your cars. So tell me what it is about Portland that makes you hop on a bike, take a bike, and head off to your destination.
Part of it is that there's a fairly compact pattern of land uses. Part of it is that the city has done things with bike lanes and with signing. And the other thing is there are a lot of people who bicycle here. So there really is strength and safety in numbers. And if you live in a community where a lot of people are cycling, then it's not as scary, and it's more likely that those people who are driving cars are used to having bikes on the road with them. And some of those people who are driving cars also ride their bike part of the time. So it's a learning phenomenon. And, you know, that's really what's happened in Portland over the last 7 or 8 years, is there's been a dramatic increase in cycling, in part because people see that it is a viable way of getting around, and it's not something that's strange or unusual.
I'm curious, you live in a residential neighborhood in Portland. Do you walk anywhere?
Yeah, actually, we have a grocery store, a couple of grocery stores that are a little over a quarter mile away from our house, so we can walk to those. In fact, a couple of days ago, my daughter and I walked to the store. Not unusual. And there are restaurants and coffee shops that we can walk to. And depending on the weather and my inclination, I'll walk or bicycle. Or if it's raining like crazy and I have to get a lot of stuff, I'll take the car.
I didn't ask you what the reduction in 1 mile per day per person is worth to the nation if, again, we did it in the top 51 metro areas that have a million or more people. What is that worth to the nation annually?
If you look at those 51 large metropolitan areas and they were all to reduce the amount of driving they do by 1 mile per person per day, that would produce a savings of about $29 billion a year for the consumers in those large metropolitan areas.
And how do you calculate those savings?
We basically look at the cost of operating a vehicle, which includes both the gasoline and maintenance, but the capital cost as well. And that works out to about 40 cents a mile. So every mile that we save saves consumers about 40 cents.
And so that would be money. It's not a savings to the government. It's actually savings to people in a community. And then that money is available to be essentially recycled through the local economy for different purposes other than foreign oil or cars made outside the community. Is that essentially the calculation you're making?
Exactly right. So every dollar that you don't spend on car payments and gasoline is money that you can spend on other things. And for the most part, those kinds of expenditures are much more likely to go to local businesses than to car companies or oil companies.
Okay, third dividend is the opportunity dividend, which is a 1 percentage point reduction in poverty. It seems to me like poverty has almost fallen off the American agenda, even to some extent the urban policy agenda. What do you make of that? Maybe you think my sense of it is wrong.
Well, poverty is a big driver of public service expenses, the cost of the public sector. So chiefly, we spend a lot of money on that section of the population that can't get its own income. You know, we're talking about, in a typical metropolitan area, 12 or 13% of the population. So part of it is it's not everybody. It's really just a segment of the population that's not necessarily the most vocal or well covered in the media.
You and I have talked about a measure that puts people who are living below the poverty rate in a better position to succeed, giving them more access to jobs and to education. And it has to do with where they live. You call it a measure of economic integration. Can you explain why you think having communities that are economically integrated strengthens a community?
Sure. Well, one of the really pernicious problems associated with poverty is really concentrated poverty. If everybody in your neighborhood is poor, that intensifies all of the problems associated with poverty. You know, you can think about crime, you can think about the quality of schools. In an economic sense, you can think about the kind of social networks that are important to finding and keeping jobs. And people who live in neighborhoods where everybody is poor are just not going to have the kind of opportunities they do in places where there's a more of a mixing of the population. And so the measure of economic integration that we use looks at the extent to which lower income people live in relatively close proximity to middle and upper income people. And in most metropolitan areas in the United States, low-income people live close to other low-income people. And our measure of economic integration measures the extent to which neighborhoods have a better mixing. And there's considerable variation across the large metropolitan areas in the United States.
And that variation exists, I'm sure, in some cases for historical purposes. That doesn't justify it, but it may explain it. It probably exists in some cases because of landscape or natural barriers. Are there ways to mitigate or are there ways to overcome economic segregation?
We know that one of the leading causes of economic segregation has been suburbanization, and particularly in places where you have lots of municipalities in the suburbs, and those municipalities zone land strictly for single-family or large-lot single-family development. If you have an entire municipality that's zoned for, say, two-acre minimum lot sizes, then it's harder for low- and moderate-income people to live in those communities. And in those cases where it's very sprawling and you have a lot of low-density development, you tend to have a much wider separation of higher-income and lower-income people, which works to the disadvantage of lower-income people in terms of, you know, physical access to job opportunities, but then also these kinds of social networks that are so important to finding and keeping jobs.
It's interesting when you talk about the percentage of people who are living below the poverty line, and you talk about 12%, which I think is the national average. I know it's much higher in some urban areas, and yet, if you think, well, okay, so you've got 12% of the people to spread across the entire landscape, giving you 88% of the people not living in those circumstances, you would think that economic integration wouldn't be that big of a challenge.
Well, absolutely. And we're seeing that in a number of metropolitan areas where, you know, you see redevelopment of close-in neighborhoods, and you get a different population mix than you have had historically in a lot of places.
What is it worth to the U.S., once again, if we could achieve this opportunity dividend by reducing poverty one percentage point in each of the top 51 metro areas in the U.S.?
When we look at that idea of reducing the poverty rate, which is typically about 12%, by one percentage point for an entire metropolitan area, and if you could do that for each of the large metropolitan areas, it would reduce the cost of anti-poverty programs, things like welfare, food stamps, Medicaid, by about $13 billion a year.
In that calculation, you have not included things like subsidized housing, extra social service costs, extra cost of policing, anything like that. You've simply said these are the direct payments we're making to people in poverty. These payments would be eliminated if people were earning above the poverty line.
Right. And that's based on the relationship that we see across metropolitan areas in terms of, you know, some areas that have larger poor populations spend that much more. So that's the experience we observe for just those expenditures across metropolitan areas.
Now, I want to clarify, and you've said this repeatedly, but just to make the point, Joe, these are metro numbers. They're not city numbers.
Right. This is for the whole metropolitan area, for all the metropolitan areas with a million or more population in the U.S., and there are 51 of those.
And why did you figure the city dividends for entire metro areas rather than cities?
Well, we think that metropolitan areas are the right unit of analysis for understanding how economies work, that cities and suburbs really function in a very interdependent way. And so to understand what the opportunity is and to accurately calculate those costs, we think you have to look at the whole metropolitan area.
So we can give our listeners an idea of what this really means at a local level. I want to just pick three communities, three metro areas, and I want you to tell me what each of the city dividends, the talent dividend, the green dividend, and the opportunity dividend would be worth to that community. Let's take Miami. What are the numbers there?
Well, for Miami, the one percentage point improvement in the college attainment rate would work out to a little over $4 billion a year for that whole metropolitan area.
Wow. What about the green dividend?
Reducing the amount of driving by about 1 mile per person per day is about $700 million a year.
And opportunity dividend, reduction in poverty by one percentage point?
In Miami, that would be almost $400 million a year.
So the total is, do the math.
The total is a little over $5 billion for Miami if they work on all three of those. Talent is where the really big gains are.
Give me the numbers for Memphis, Joe.
Well, for Memphis, the talent dividend would work out to about $1 billion a year in additional personal income from a 1 percentage point improvement in the college attainment rate. The green dividend is about a $200 million gain, and the opportunity dividend there is about a $100 million gain.
And so the total is?
Total is about $1.3 billion.
$1.3 billion. Do you have any estimate? I know the biggest employer in Memphis, of course, is FedEx. Do you have any idea what FedEx's payroll would be, or could you estimate it? I'm kind of curious to compare it to that city dividends number.
I don't know the FedEx payroll, but it's probably a little less than that $1 billion figure.
So basically, Memphis could say, okay, we can get a 1 percentage point gain in college attainment in Memphis, or we could attract another FedEx employing that many people.
Those two things would be about in the same ballpark.
Wow. And one would probably be highly unachievable. Okay, let's take one more city, Chicago.
Okay.
Metro area, Chicago. Tell me what the talent, the green, and the opportunity dividend would be for Chicago.
Yeah, a 1 percentage point improvement in the college attainment rate in the Chicago metro area would work out to about a $7 billion gain in total personal income. Reducing driving by about 1 mile per person per day would produce a gain of about $1.6 billion in the Chicago region. And the opportunity dividend gain there would be a little over $700 million. So the total for those three would be around $10 billion gain.
Those are extraordinary numbers. And they really are when you think about them. It's interesting, though. I think in some ways, putting these numbers out there for urban leaders, community leaders, citizens to think about, it challenges sort of conventional wisdom around economic development or the siloed way in which we normally approach things in communities. So talent, that's up to you educators. Green, oh, that's just a bunch of individual decisions. Nobody has anything to do with that. We can't control how many, you know, miles people drive. And poverty, throw up our hands. We don't know what to do about poverty. I mean, it seems that there's some bridge building to be done.
Yeah, as I said, there aren't any silver bullets in any of these three areas. And it really takes concerted action across a series of sectors and policies in order to achieve these gains. But if you can do that, the gains themselves are very substantial, which suggests there are really good reasons why folks ought to focus on these three items.
Joe, I want to ask you, I want to shift gears a minute and ask you about the economic stimulus package, and it's coming down very, very fast. I think the horse is out of the barn on this one. But if you were whispering in the president's ear, what would you tell him to invest in?
You should look for two things. One would be, you know, obviously you have to do stuff quickly. This recession is unfolding day by day, and we have to do something to counteract the psychology of the marketplace right now. That said, I think I would look for opportunities to do things that are transformative and that move us in the right direction. And if you think about that green dividend, the kind of investments in sustainability that give people a different set of options that enable them to, for example, save money by driving less. So I think investments in transit, investments in walkability, and then also investments in energy conservation generally, home weatherization and retrofitting public buildings, those pay long-term gains and help us be more sustainable. So those would be the kinds of things that I'd focus on. And they also create lots of jobs.
Yeah. Is there a way to spend the stimulus to advance this idea of the talent dividend?
There is, and probably the most important thing the federal government can do there is help states and localities avoid layoffs in the public school system. It makes very little sense to try and create jobs by hiring construction workers at the same time you're laying off teachers and police and firemen. So the low-hanging fruit from the stimulus there is just stopping the loss in the state and local governments, because state and local governments, unlike the federal government, can't deficit spend, and they are the ones who do the lion's share of the financial support for education in the United States. So hopefully the stimulus package will help state and local governments keep teachers and other educators and public employees on the job.
You live in Portland, Oregon. How is Portland holding up in the downturn?
We're experiencing the downturn really the same as is everyone else. Unemployment rates are up pretty sharply. From a public finance standpoint, we're a little bit better off than other places because we don't have a sales tax, because consumer spending has dropped so precipitously in this recession. States that rely heavily on sales taxes have been the hardest hit, although we'll see the impact with a little bit of a lag because we depend on the income tax and on capital gains more than the typical state. So as all of those losses in stock markets and decline in housing value sort of ripple through the tax system, we'll see declines a little bit later than some other states.
That brings up a question that I have. If you were to design the tax structure that would hold up the best in a recession, what would it look like?
You know, actually, ironically, property taxes are holding up pretty well in our state, but that's a fluke due to the way we do assessments. In some states, the property taxes are declining precipitously because they go down with property values. We have a bit of a disconnect in that system. So, yeah, I'm not sure there's a perfect answer to that because every recession is a little bit different. Every state is a little bit different. And I don't know that you can really fully insulate yourself from the effects of recessions.
You have a new mayor, Sam Adams. He has just been sworn into office. What do you expect from the new mayor?
Oh, Sam is a very energetic and aggressive mayor, and he's a bundle of energy, and I know he'll be involved in a broad series of issues. He's very interested in improving the city schools, dealing transportation issues, and improving the sustainability of our city going forward. So I'm sure he'll be active in all three of those areas.
Joe, it is always a pleasure to have you on Smart City. Thanks so much for being our guest.
My pleasure, Carol.
Joe Courtwright is an economist for Impresa Consulting, and he joined us from his home in Portland, Oregon. His latest work, conducted with CEOs for cities, is called City Dividends. We have a link to the full report on our website, smartcityradio.com. Coming up after a short break, we'll speak with an online innovator, Adrian Holovaty, about his website, everyblock.com. Everyblock scours the web for news, blog entries, pictures, crime reports that focus on your neighborhood. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Adrian Holovaty is one of the pioneers of journalism on the web. After a career as a web developer and journalist, he created everyblock.com. The site gathers civic information, news updates, and photos from across the web that relate to your neighborhood right down to your home address. Adrian joined us in our offices to talk about the site. Adrian, what was your impulse for Everyblock?
Well, for a number of years, I've operated a site called ChicagoCrime.org here in Chicago that let residents search for crime in their neighborhoods. And I always thought it would be cool to add more information to that so that you can type in an address and see not just crime, but everything that's happened recently around there. So public records, news reports, fun, wacky things from across the internet, etc.
So what was the impulse for the crime site?
Well, back in 2005, Google had just released its Google Maps mapping application, and due to some of the technology decisions that they made, it was possible for people to reverse engineer that and add maps to their own sites. And I also, at the same time, had found the Chicago Police Department's crime site, and I thought, wow, this is a lot of really interesting data that is just genuinely useful to Chicago residents, and it would be cool if there were some alternate ways of browsing it. So I took my little experimentation with Google Maps and put it together with this crime data and made the site called ChicagoCrime.org back in 2005.
And how did you come to this work?
Well, my background is in journalism and computer science. I've carved out this really wacky niche of making web applications that are interactive, you know, databases of information, but in a journalism context. So data that tells stories.
Describe Everyblock. Describe the site and how it works.
The basic concept is that you enter your address or your neighborhood or your zip code, and you get a personalized page for your immediate location. And that page includes any and every piece of information that we can find that's happened near you. So three general categories. One is we catalog news articles throughout the city. So anything that may have been written about by your daily newspapers, your community weeklies, your local blogs, we catalog all that and tell you which articles you may be interested in based on your location. The second thing is a wide variety of public records. So every crime near you, every restaurant inspection, so you can see whether your pizza place is past inspection.
You don't want to know that.
And building permits, business licenses. You can see which businesses have applied for licenses in your neighborhood, liquor licenses, all sorts of this civic data. And then the third big bucket is wacky stuff from across the internet. So photos that have been posted to photo sharing websites that have been geotagged, in other words, marked as having been taken in your neighborhood from sites like Flickr, and restaurant reviews on sites like Yelp.com. And the thinking here is that it's news to you that someone has written about something in your neighborhood or has taken a photo about something in your neighborhood. So we just put it all into the mix.
What's the most popular feature on the site?
Well, it's most definitely our crime statistics, but that number is skewed because since we launched EveryBlock, I've redirected ChicagoCrime.org to the site, and that means that all the people who were going to Chicago Crime now go to EveryBlock, and they don't necessarily know that there's all the other stuff on EveryBlock, so it skews the numbers.
Do you think it will continue that way?
Probably, because it tends to be the, I want to say sexiest, but it's not really sexy. It's the most...
Urgent
and sort of guttural, you know, primal thing, like, will I live to see tomorrow? You know, like, am I going to get mugged on my way to the train station?
Why don't you include a feature that allows users to find their alderman or their state representative or their congressman?
That's a really good question. Our focus for the moment has been on news. So everything that you see on our site is date and time sensitive. When you go to your address page, for example, you'll see a very basic timeline of what's happened recently. Our thinking is, at the moment at least, that if you are a returning visitor to our site, you're checking out all the new news in your neighborhood, you already know where you go vote, you already know where your neighborhood grocery store is or where you go catch the train. But we've had so much demand for that we might add it at some point.
I think you should add it. Let me add my voice to that. In fact, there's no activist aspect of the site, and you've explained why. There's no way to figure out how to volunteer or get politically engaged. Is one of the reasons that there's no standard source of information for it? There's nothing you can draw from, and since you're not generating original content, there's not a source for you?
Sure. One thing that we do want to add is upcoming events in your neighborhood, and that would certainly include activism stuff. It's just a matter of us adding that capability. So right now, everything, again, is based on what happened today and before, as opposed to what's happening later today and into the future. So it's only a matter of time before we add that stuff.
And would you imagine providing a method for users of the site to enter that data themselves or enter that information themselves, or would you try to draw on some other resource?
It's feasible. Our strategy so far has been that we don't want to reinvent a photo sharing site. We don't want to reinvent a restaurant review site. So we say that if you desperately want one of your photographs to show up on EveryBlock, here's how you go to Flickr, this third-party site, and if you submit it in such and such a way, it'll show up on our site. So we don't want to reinvent those things. It's kind of, you know, the friendly web way of doing things, how linking out to things rather than being one centralized location. Mm-hmm. So with regard to events, there's already a bunch of event sites that we might be able to tap into. But again, one thing we do add to the table is this neighborhood civic focus that I'm not really familiar with any event site that collects events of that nature.
Because it occurred to me there are looking at the site and typing in my own zip code, as I've done several times, there are people down the hall from me I don't know.
Sure.
And it just struck me that this is telling me so much about my neighborhood, but nothing about my neighbors.
Right. So this is another thing that a lot of people have requested. And I would like to add that sort of functionality, and that would be basically like a meetup.com, but for your immediate area. I think that's a really powerful concept. And I guess all I'd have to say is stay tuned.
Okay. What would you most like to add to the site?
There are all sorts of pieces of information that we have campaigned for from governments, but we haven't yet had access to, such as 311 information here mm-hmm. for the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So that's like every...
That'd be great.
Oh, yeah.
Every
pothole reported, every, you know, rat sighting, every sighting of vandalism, you know, all that stuff.
I think that would be phenomenal. I had a rat sighting the other night.
Oh, yes. I've had my share.
So that would be interesting. 311 data would be very interesting to see.
311 would be good. And I will say that we do have it already for Washington, D.C.
You do?
One interesting thing about working on this project is that every city is different.
In terms of their willingness to share?
Their willingness to share, the availability of data in the first place, even the nature of the information. Like in some cities, we might have movie filmings, but in others, like Charlotte, North Carolina, there a lot of filmings don't happen there. Like earthquakes data is something that we've looked into for Los Angeles and San Francisco, two of our cities. We ended up tossing that because an earthquake isn't really micro-local. It sort of either hits the city or doesn't, at least according to the data that we looked at. It's really interesting from a civic perspective, looking at the various cities and seeing what they offer and how much of it they offer, how much of it they're hiding or don't have digitized. And we've sort of become domain experts at that very small area of figuring out what this particular municipality offers to the public and what it doesn't.
Do you have pending zoning applications on
the
site?
We do in San Francisco, and I believe in Charlotte. We don't in our other cities. I may be missing one that we do have, but
run down the cities that are part of every block.
So we launched with Chicago, New York City, every borough there, and San Francisco. And then since then we've added Philadelphia, Charlotte, Seattle, Washington, D.C., Boston, and Los Angeles.
What level of conversation do you have to have in each city? Where do you enter the discussion with a city to try to get the data?
So it really depends on the department. We do a substantial amount of research into sort of how the city works, the political implications of everything. And for one department, we might approach it by writing a letter to the main honcho. For another city, we might try to just call, you know, the main line. For another city, we might know someone who knows someone, and that helps us. It really is completely
city by city.
City by city, department by department even.
Okay, so who's the main honcho? Is that the mayor? Is that the IT guy? Who's the main honcho?
That, again, is different sort of politically depending on the nature of the city. In the department, it would be sort of like the superintendent or the director of the department. In a city like Chicago, it would be obviously Mayor Daley. Yeah, it really, again, does depend on the city and the department.
Have you had the conversations in Chicago around 311?
We have, and we were told that the city is working on a data sharing policy, which is very intriguing. It's been a couple months, so we're still hoping they're working on it. And supposedly, once they're done, they'll have a firm city policy on we're trying to share data with the public and with these independent news organizations like Every Block, and here's our policy for what we share and what we don't share.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Adrian Hulivati about his website, everyblock.com. Everyblock scours the web for news, blog entries, pictures, crime reports that focus on your neighborhood. The Knight Foundation has helped you fund expansion of the site.
Yes. It is our only funding.
Your only funding. What is it they see in Everyblock? Why are they helping you enter new markets and funding you and making it possible for you to devote full time to this?
Well, this site is the result of a journalism contest called the Knight News Challenge. And the idea of the contest was to invite wacky ideas that could possibly expand and innovate in the world of journalism. So my background is in journalism, always, you know, working for newspaper websites. And the incentive that Knight Foundation has in funding us is that they're getting two things out of it. One, we're a test bed for the news industry. So if we succeed, if we fail, whatever happens, anyone in the news industry will be able to see, oh, hey, that was actually a pretty good idea, or hey, that was a bad idea to provide news for people at such a granular level. And then the second thing that they get is that it's a tangible outcome, and that's our open source code. So at the end of our grant period, which is in the middle of next year, 2009, we are going to open source the code that powers the site. So in other words, what that makes possible is any citizen, anyone, whether it's a news organization or just a citizen or even the government itself, will be able to take our code and create an Everyblock-ish site for their own city.
Where does that leave you?
That is a really great question. We have yet to figure out how we're going to feed our families once the grant runs out. We could do the classic open source business model, which has been done by companies like Red Hat, where the code is free, but you pay for support and services and that sort of thing. Like, essentially, it would be a consultancy. The other option is that we can start adding some local advertising, specifically that micro level. I've just heard a lot about businesses not really having an outlet for advertising at such a local level. It's either you advertise with the newspaper in town and you reach thousands of people that you really don't care to reach, and you pay for that privilege even though you might not want to. Or you go with something like Google, which is not really locally based, it's more keyword based. So we could play around with that too.
You know, I was thinking about the coupons that are delivered, right, for restaurants and local services, salons and so forth, to condos. And the chances of those coupons actually getting into my kitchen are not very good, because, I mean, they're put in strange places, they're put on the backside of the postal area, which I don't go to, or whatever. And I was thinking that would make so much sense for Everyblock.
Yeah, if you open those coupons at all. Like, I tend to toss that stuff out just with the rest of the mail spam. Yeah, that would be a fantastic addition to our site, and I look forward to experimenting with it.
Well, let me ask you something. Does it matter that people know more about their neighborhood if they don't understand the larger context of the city in which their neighborhood resides? In other words, do you think people can be too parochial?
That's something that we always try to avoid doing. But I think our main argument is that you have a more fundamental, not only an understanding, but a more fundamental level of caring in sort of city processes if it directly affects your life. So an example is sign permits in New York City. It's really obscure topic, right? Like signs. Like, so in order for a business to have a sign of a certain size, you need to apply for a sign permit. And there's a, you know, multi-step process with that. And, you know, what percentage of New York City residents actually know or care about that process? Extremely low, probably less than 0.5%. But because on the Everyblock New York City version, we have sign permits, we've done the work of not only showing you what's happening in your neighborhood in the world of sign permits, but we also say how it fits into the bigger picture. So we employ a managing editor whose job it is to explain all of this information. And if it's something that has to do with a process, like a liquor license or a sign permit or a building permit, we try to very clearly explain the entire process. And for many of these data types, for every step in the process, you'll see a notification on your every block page. So for liquor licenses, for example, you might see, oh, this restaurant applied for a liquor license. And then maybe a month or two later, you'll see, oh, the license was approved. And then at the end of this spectrum, we have, oh, this license was discontinued for whatever reason. So because we have those little micro snippets, we think that that gets people more interested in the bigger process.
Have you thought about doing metrics like crime is up, crime is down, or this kind of crime is up, you know, and, or home prices, housing prices in your zip code are up or down?
Right now, we've been doing more of that lately. For every type of information we have just a very basic how many things were there per day. So if it's crime, there's like, you know, 800 crimes were reported today, 796 were yesterday. That isn't very helpful, of course. So we are looking into more intelligent aggregation. Not only, so there's two aspects to this. One is doing the aggregation ourselves and picking out the interesting trends. And the second is giving the users the tools to
do it themselves,
which is much more interesting.
It's exciting what you're doing. You invite users on the site to send in their suggestions. What have they told you?
Ooh, so I assume you're referring to the feedback at the bottom of every single page. So I would wholeheartedly recommend this technique to anyone who's operating a website in the world. It's fantastic. And just to explain what I mean by this, at the bottom of every single page on every block, there's a little form where we say, you know, comments, love letters, critiques, please send them our way. And we get a dozen or so of these every day from all sorts of people. At the beginning, we were getting a lot of feedback that suggested people didn't really understand what our site did. They thought that we were the official government source, or they thought we were the news outlet that we were linking to. So we made some changes. In the next incarnation, it was kind of funny. We started getting a lot of reports like, put more cops on the streets and we'll clean up the vandalism. I was like, why are they asking this? Or why are they saying this? And it turns out that the way our question was worded, it was, how can we make every block better? And it was being answered by people who didn't necessarily realize that every block was the name of a website, not like literally every block. How can we make every block better? Put more cops on the streets, you know? So we've reworded that.
That's really, I love that. Well, Adrian, I appreciate what you're doing for every block, and thanks for being our guest on Smart
sure,
City.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Adrian Holovaty is the creator of Every Block. We'll have a link to the site on our site, smartcityradio.com, so you can see what's going on your block. Finally this week, when the weather turns nasty, it can leave you feeling a little helpless. This week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith is reminded of some freak weather and how sometimes bad things can happen to good people.
Back in 2002, the Upper South was clobbered by one of those storms of the century. An ice storm blanketed North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia during the night and early morning hours of December 4th and 5th. 2 million people in the Carolinas lost power, and the governor of North Carolina dispatched the National Guard into 21 counties to go door to door and offer assistance. During the aftermath, a Duke Power spokesperson said that it was taking, quote unquote, heroic efforts by its crews to cope with the damage. Many cities and communities experienced record amounts of freezing rain, and new records for an extreme weather event were set all across the region for power outages, traffic accidents, school closings, and fatalities. To put it in perspective, the previous record for power outages had been set by Hurricane Hugo in 1989. Some areas, especially Charlotte and Raleigh, North Carolina, were effectively shut down for over a week. FEMA moved in to provide disaster relief, and 37 counties in North Carolina were declared federal disaster areas. The company I work for is headquartered in the Research Triangle area of North Carolina, which was one of the hardest hit by this storm. What I remember most about it is the experience of a person we had just hired a few months before to run our sales group. He had moved his wife and two young daughters with their two cats and three birds from the Bay Area in California just a few weeks before. When the storm hit, they were still unpacking moving boxes. They were without power for over a week and knew virtually no one in the area. When they were finally able to get out of their neighborhood to restock groceries, they had no place to cook meals. So each evening they drove over icy roads to the office, which was closed, but which had power. Nobody at the office knew they were having to do this, but there in the small kitchen in the office break room, they would microwave their meals and have a family dinner. We joke about it now, but I sometimes think about it as a reminder of just how fragile our connection to well-being can be. If we are not prepared and resilient, an unexpected turn of events can wipe us out. And this need not be the weather. In fact, the slowing economy has done this very thing to millions of Americans in recent months. When it's the weather, though, everybody gets immediate help. When it's the economy, we tend to forget that the plight in which people find themselves is not all their fault. Economic storms can also overwhelm our best planning and reserves and sever our fragile connections to well-being. And no less than what we do for those made homeless by Mother Nature, so too must we do for those made homeless by the fickle and often perverse swings of the almighty dollar. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. If you want to read the full report of the City Dividends, you can go to our website, smartcityradio.com. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or drop us a line and let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or send us email at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He hopes he doesn't have to become president before he gets a dog. I'm Carol Coletta.